Chapter 7. I have a change. The carrier's horse was the laziest horse in the world, I should hope, and shuffled along, with his head down, as if he liked to keep people waiting to whom the packages were directed. I fancied, indeed, that he sometimes chuckled audibly over this reflection, but the carrier said he was only troubled with a cough. The carrier had a way of keeping his head down, like his horse, and of drooping sleepily forward as he drove, with one of his arms on each of his knees. I say drove, but it struck me that the cart would have gone to Yarmouth quite as well without him, for the horse did all that, and as to conversation, he had no idea of it but whistling. Peggotty had a basket of refreshments on her knee, which would have lasted us out handsomely if we had been going to London by the same conveyance. We ate a good deal, and slept a good deal. Peggotty always went to sleep with her chin upon the handle of the basket, her hold of which never relaxed, and I could not have believed, unless I had heard her do it, that one defenseless woman could have snored so much. We made so many deviations up and down lanes, and were such a long time delivering a bedstead at a public house, and calling at other places, that I was quite tired, and very glad, when we saw Yarmouth. It looked rather spongy and soppy, I thought, as I carried my eye over the great dull waste that lay across the river, and I could not help wondering, if the world were really as round as my geography book said, how any part of it came to be so flat. But I reflected that Yarmouth might be situated at one of the poles, which would account for it. As we drew a little nearer, and saw the whole adjacent prospect lying a straight low line under the sky, I hinted to Peggotty that a mound or so might have improved it, and also that, if the land had been a little more separated from the sea, and the town and the tide had not been quite so much mixed up, like toast and water, it would have been nicer. But Peggotty said, with greater emphasis than usual, that we must take things as we found them, and that, for her part, she was proud to call herself a Yarmouth bloater. When we got into the street, which was strange enough to me, and smelt the fish, and pitch, and oakum, and tar, and saw the sailors walking about, and the carts jingling up and down over the stones, I felt that I had done so busy a place an injustice, and said as much to Peggotty, who heard my expressions of delight with great complacency, and told me it was well known, I suppose, to those who had the good fortune to be born bloaters, that Yarmouth was, upon the whole, the finest place in the universe. Here's my am. Apostrophe, apostrophe, screamed Peggotty, growed out of knowledge. Apostrophe, he was waiting for us, in fact, at the public house, and asked me how I found myself, like an old acquaintance. I did not feel, at first, that I knew him as well as he knew me, because he had never come to our house since the night I was born, and naturally he had the advantage of me. But our intimacy was much advanced by his taking me on his back to carry me home. He was, now, a huge strong fellow of 6 feet high, broad in proportion, and round-shouldered, but with a simpering boy's face and curly light hair that gave him quite a sheepish look. He was dressed in a canvas jacket and a pair of such very stiff trousers that they would have stood quite as well alone, without any legs in them. And you couldn't so properly have said he wore a hat as that he was covered in a top, like an old building, with something pitchy. Ham carrying me on his back, and a small box of ours under his arm, and Peggotty carrying another small box of ours, we turned down lanes best strewn with bits of chips and little hillocks of sand, and went past gasworks, rope walks, boatbuilders' yards, shipwrights' yards, shipbreakers' yards, caulkers' yards, riggers' lofts, smiths' forges, and a great litter of such places, until we came out upon the dull waste I had already seen at a distance, when Ham said, "Yon's our house, Master Davy." Apostrophe, apostrophe, I looked in all directions, as far as I could stare over the wilderness, and away at the sea, and away at the river, but no house could I make out. There was a black barge, or some other kind of superannuated boat, not far off, high and dry on the ground, with an iron funnel sticking out of it for a chimney and smoking very cozily, but nothing else in the way of a habitation that was visible to me. That's not it. ... said one. That ship-looking thing? That's it, Master Davy, returned Ham. If it had been Aladdin's palace, rocks, egg and all, I suppose I could not have been more charmed with the romantic idea of living in it. There was a delightful door cut in the side, and it was roofed in, and there were little windows in it. But the wonderful charm of it was, that it was a real boat which had no doubt been upon the water hundreds of times, and which had never been intended to be lived in, on dry land. That was the captivation of it to me. If it had ever been meant to be lived in, I might have thought it small, or inconvenient, or lonely, but never having been designed for any such use, it became a perfect abode. It was beautifully clean inside, and as tidy as possible. There was a table, and a Dutch clock, and a chest of drawers, and on the chest of drawers there was a tea tray with a painting on it of a lady with a parasol, taking a walk with a military-looking child who was trundling a hoop. The tray was kept from tumbling down, by a Bible, and the tray, if it had tumbled down, would have smashed a quantity of cups and saucers and a teapot that were grouped around the book. On the walls there were some common colored pictures, framed and glazed, of scripture subjects, such as I have never seen since in the hands of peddlers, without seeing the whole interior of Peggotty's brother's house again, at one view. Abraham in red going to sacrifice Isaac in blue, and Daniel in yellow cast into a den of green lions, were the most prominent of these. Over the little mantel shelf was a picture of the Sarah Jane Lugger, built at Sunderland, with a real little wooden stern stuck onto it, a work of art, combining composition with carpentry, which I considered to be one of the most enviable possessions that the world could afford. There were some hooks in the beams of the ceiling, the use of which I did not divine then, and some lockers and boxes and conveniences of that sort, which served for seats and eked out the chairs. All this I saw in the first glance, after I crossed the threshold childlike, according to my theory, and then Peggotty opened a little door, and showed me my bedroom. It was the completest and most desirable bedroom ever seen in the stern of the vessel, with a little window, where the rudder used to go through, a little looking glass, just the right height for me, nailed against the wall, and framed with oyster shells, a little bed, which there was just room enough to get into, and a nosegay of seaweed in a blue mug on the table. The walls were whitewashed as white as milk, and the patchwork counterpane made my eyes quite ache with its brightness. One thing I particularly noticed in this delightful house was the smell of fish, which was so searching that when I took out my pocket handkerchief to wipe my nose, I found it smelt exactly as if it had wrapped up a lobster. On my imparting this discovery in confidence to Peggotty, she informed me that her brother dealt in lobsters, crabs, and crawfish, and I afterwards found that a heap of these creatures, in a state of wonderful conglomeration with one another, and never leaving off pinching whatever they laid hold of, were usually to be found in a little wooden outhouse, where the pots and kettles were kept. We were welcomed by a very civil woman in a white apron, whom I had seen curtsying at the door, when I was on Ham's back, about a quarter of a mile off. Likewise by a most beautiful little girl, or I thought her so, with a necklace of blue beads on, who wouldn't let me kiss her when I offered to, but ran away and hid herself. By and by, when we had dined in a sumptuous manner off boiled dabs, melted butter, and potatoes, with a chop for me, a hairy man with a very good-natured face came home. As he called Peggotty lass, and gave her a hearty smack on the cheek, I had no doubt, from the general propriety of her conduct, that he was her brother, and so he turned out being presently introduced to me as Mr. Peggotty, the master of the house. "Glad to see you, sir," said Mr. Peggotty. "You'll find us rough, sir, but you'll find us ready." I thanked him, and replied that I was sure I should be happy in such a delightful place. How's your ma, sir? ' said Mr. Peggotty. Did you leave her pretty jolly? ' I gave Mr. Peggotty to understand that she was as jolly as I could wish, and that she desired her compliments, which was a polite fiction on my part. I'm much obliged to her, I'm sure, said Mr. Peggotty. Well, sir, if you can make out here, for a fortnight, long wire, nodding at his sister, and Ham, and little Emily, we shall be proud of your company. Having done the honors of his house in this hospitable manner, Mr. Peggotty went out to wash himself in a kettle full of hot water, remarking that cold would never get his muck off. He soon returned, greatly improved in appearance, but so rubicund that I couldn't help thinking his face had this in common with the lobsters, crabs, and crawfish, that it went into the hot water very black, and came out very red. After tea, when the door was shut, and all was made snug, the nights being cold and misty now, it seemed to me the most delicious retreat that the imagination of man could conceive. To hear the wind getting up out at sea, to know that the fog was creeping over the desolate flat outside, and to look at the fire, and think that there was no house near but this one, and this one a boat, was like enchantment. Little Emily had overcome her shyness, and was sitting by my side upon the lowest and least of the lockers, which was just large enough for us two, and just fitted into the chimney corner. Mrs. Peggotty with the white apron was knitting on the opposite side of the fire. Peggotty at her needlework was as much at home with St. Paul's and the bit of wax candle as if they had never known any other roof. Ham, who had been giving me my first lesson in all fours, was trying to recollect a scheme of telling fortunes with the dirty cards, and was printing off fishy impressions of his thumb on all the cards he turned. Mr. Peggotty was smoking his pipe. I felt it was a time for conversation and confidence. Mr. Peggotty. Says one. Sir, says he. Did you give your son the name of Ham, because you lived in a sort of ark? Mr. Peggotty seemed to think it a deep idea, but answered. No, sir. I never give him no name. Who gave him that name, then? Said I, putting question number two of the catechism to Mr. Peggotty. Why, sir, his father gave it him, said Mr. Peggotty. I thought you were his father. My brother Joe was his father, said Mr. Peggotty. Dead, Mr. Peggotty? I hinted, after a respectful pause. Drowned, said Mr. Peggotty. I was very much surprised that Mr. Peggotty was not Ham's father, and began to wonder whether I was mistaken about his relationship to anybody else there. I was so curious to know that I made up my mind to have it out with Mr. Peggotty. Little Emily, I said, glancing at her. She is your daughter, isn't she, Mr. Peggotty? No, sir. My brother-in-law, Tom, was her father. I couldn't help it. Dead, Mr. Peggotty? I hinted, after another respectful silence. Drowned, said Mr. Peggotty. I felt the difficulty of resuming the subject, but had not got to the bottom of it yet, and must get to the bottom somehow. So I said, haven't you any children, Mr. Peggotty? No, master, he answered with a short laugh. I'm a bachelor. A bachelor. I said, astonished. Why, who's that, Mr. Peggotty? Pointing to the person in the apron who was knitting. That's Mrs. Gummidge, said Mr. Peggotty. Gummidge, Mr. Peggotty? But at this point Peggotty, I mean my own peculiar Peggotty, made such impressive motions to me, not to ask any more questions, that I could only sit and look at all the silent company until it was time to go to bed. Then, in the privacy of my own little cabin, she informed me that Tam and Emily were an orphan nephew and niece, whom my host had at different times adopted in their childhood, when they were left destitute. And that Mrs. Gummidge was the widow of his partner in a boat, who had died very poor. He was but a poor man himself, said Peggotty, but as good as gold, and as true as steel. Those were her similes. The only subject, she informed me, on which he ever showed a violent temper, or swore an oath, was this generosity of his, and if it were ever referred to, by any one of them, he struck the table a heavy blow with his right hand,
had split it on one such occasion,
and swore a dreadful oath, that he would be gormed, if he didn't cut, and run for good, if it was ever mentioned again. It appeared, in answer to my inquiries, that nobody had the least idea of the etymology of this terrible verb passive to be gormed, but that they all regarded it as constituting a most solemn imprecation. I was very sensible of my entertainer's goodness, and listened to the women's going to bed in another little crib like mine at the opposite end of the boat, and to him, and Ham hanging up two hammocks for themselves on the hooks I had noticed in the roof, in a very luxurious state of mind, enhanced by my being sleepy. As slumber gradually stole upon me, I heard the wind howling out at sea and coming on across the flat so fiercely, that I had a lazy apprehension of the great deep rising in the night. But I bethought myself, that I was in a boat after all, and that a man like Mr. Peggotty was not a bad person to have on board, if anything did happen. Nothing happened, however, worse than morning. Almost as soon as it shone upon the oyster shell frame of my mirror I was out of bed, and out with little Emily, picking up stones upon the beach. You're quite a sailor, I suppose? ? I said to Emily. I don't know that I supposed anything of the kind, but I felt it an act of gallantry to say something, and a shining sail close to us made such a pretty little image of itself, at the moment, in her bright eye, that it came into my head to say this. No, replied Emily, shaking her head, I'm afraid of the sea. Afraid? I said, with a becoming air of boldness, and looking very Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.